I think preferably people would publish my books entirely in black with no names on them, and they would throw them through people's windows at night with like a rock attached to them, and just kind of, you know, just like a threatening, like just I would like things that I write to be kind of a vague existential threat, you know, and so then you're reading it with that kind of unknowing fear.
The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Julian Fields is a Swiss novelist, filmmaker, and visual artist. Throughout his life, Julian has lived across South America, Europe, and the United States, and he currently works and lives in Los Angeles, California. He's a guest this week as we discuss his novel with Zero Books, Fire Hides Everywhere. It's Thursday, November 9th, 2017, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. I want to remind you that we've moved the Inside Zero Books podcast from the Zero Books blog to Patreon. This will make it easier to get the members-only podcast on podcatchers. It also means that we'll be repeating the first year of Inside Zero Books daily on our Patreon account. If you've missed Inside Zero Books the first time, or if you just want to hear the old episodes again, they'll be available. And if you're a former member who emailed your address to take me up on the Zero Books parting gift of a random paperback, that should be on its way today or tomorrow. I also want to urge you to pick up Anselm Jaep's The Writing on the Wall. And you might also get a hold of Philip Cunliffe's Linen Lives. And of course, if you haven't read it already, get yourself a copy of Angela Nagel's Kill All Normies. It's guaranteed to transform any leftist get-together into a struggle session. The music you're listening to right now is Close to the Edit by The Art of Noise, only as played on two pianos for eight hands and produced by Trevor Horn. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Julian Fields discuss and describe his novel, Fire Hides Everywhere. Julian Field is a visual artist working primarily with film, video, and photography, as well as a fiction author. He was born in Uruguay and is of Swiss nationality, but he currently lives and works in the city of Los Angeles, and his novel, Fire Hides Everywhere, is coming out with Zero Books this month. So, Julian Field, welcome to the Zero Books podcast.
Thank you so much, Doug. It's been a pleasure corresponding by email, and now I am here in person.
Well, in Skype.
That is as much of my person as I feel comfortable revealing.
Yeah, I feel exactly the same way. Let me read the description of your book, and then you can elaborate on it from there. Following an apocalypse in which all except those just born or who are about to die have disappeared, Julian Field's novel sets out to explore the eternal Buddhist question, who is born, who dies? As the young are left to define their lives untethered, an old man begins to enlist them as placeholders for those who are no longer present. When he suffers a violent stroke and loses his capacity as a caregiver, he continues to operate structurally in the lives of the young people who are left to fend for themselves. Begging the question, do structures live on beyond the lives of those inhabiting them?
I don't want to say it's a post-apocalyptic book because that's not really what it focuses on, but there's a sense that a great conflict has occurred and only the very youngest and the very oldest are left behind. Basically, those who weren't able-bodied or who weren't considered able-bodied enough to become instruments of war in some way. there are actually very few characters in this book. I've been told by my editor, who worked with me across three different novels now, that I have a tendency to isolate my characters and send them into the middle of nowhere to kind of face themselves. So there's a sense of that happening, and the main character, who's in quite decent physical shape as the story kicks off, he has decided to take care of a variety of different children that he has found near where he lives at this big farmhouse in the Berry region of France. And so he takes care of all these children, and the book begins with him having essentially a stroke and that kind of precipitating dementia and a kind of general degradation of his state, mostly mentally. He's all right physically for most of it. This kind of opens a breach in the children's world, certainly, because they were living in a state of relative chaos, having experienced all the different things they experienced before coming to this farmhouse and fitting into this bizarre system that the man has, which is, I would describe it as unsentimental almost. You know, he's very functional about the way he takes care of them, and he goes through the motions. You know, he's very almost professional about it. But they have their own impulses and instincts to deal with, and their experiences, which have not been kind to most of them. The loss of their loved ones, whatever isolation they were living in previously. So they start to descend into chaos as the structure of what was keeping them in line falls apart. And on the old man's side, he actually begins to relive parts of his life. One of the main features of dementia is displacement of past moments and past personalities in your life onto whoever's present physically. So he starts to relive moments of his life and has these children incarnating a variety of people that are gone. It's simultaneously this new beginning for the children that is definitely more chaotic and definitely more up to them. And then there's this dangerous, let's say a man who was very constant and very consistent in the way that he acted becomes very inconsistent and at times violent. So they have to figure out how they're going to function both within the hierarchy of the kids and in regards to Christopher, the old man. This idea of the search for identity is not explicit in my writing. In my previous novel, I always wrote from the first-person perspective. This is the first time that I've shifted. But you'll still see elements of the prose being deformed by whatever mind is being portrayed. For Christophe, the old man, I think his identity lies very much in structure. I think that his emotional self, or, you know, whatever one might describe as like his soul, is perhaps in stasis, or it's just being displaced in some way. And he's just functioning structurally. And as soon as that structure starts to somewhat collapse, like that he cannot perform what he sees as his duty, he starts to undergo depersonalization and feelings of like, who am I? And what am I doing here? Why am I taking care of these children? And am I going to not be able to do this? And what does that mean for who I am and like my purpose? Obviously, the situation that he's in and the situation that everybody is in it's pretty precarious. There's a sense of how long can this last? There is no electricity. He goes and scavenges for gas, which he runs a stove on, and he does cook for the children with that. And he has a gas water system in the old farm. There's a sense of this world rotting on the vine. He has a garden out back, which is his way of, I guess, of creating life, which is no longer possible otherwise. And the children just aren't allowed to go into that garden, or at least that's the rule that has been established until then. And that becomes... it's no longer inviolate very quickly. There's quite a few scenes that play out in the garden.
Wait a minute! Who are you?
I'm not entirely sure we have fixed selves other than in relationship to the other. Very early, I think I remember in college, just... being a real pain in the ass at parties, explaining to people how Aristotelian poetics had failed, and that Western narrative structure and the hero's story and all this stuff was boring. And so I was probably a pretty bad dinner guest. I spend hours talking to people, asking them to walk me through parts of their lives and the internal physical workings of their body and their minds, and describe how their thoughts cycle and stuff like that. So I'm not a huge research guy, but when I do research, it tends to be like very primary source like that. And usually I try to do it with people who have lived through hell, you know, in some way, because they've experienced a more diverse range of things, right? From joy to despair and anger and complete inebriation, disorientation, trauma. So I'm interested in that entire range, certainly, of experiences and how those play out in the body and the mind. And my first novel is based on an extensive amount of research and then transcription. I'm essentially carrying the message of others. This is actually chapter 6 on page 12. Christoph reemerged from the farmhouse carrying a black plastic box with orange latches. From it, he produced a pair of scissors, kneeled over the child, and set to work. He cut the dress from hem to neckline, split the sleeves, and peeled it open. At first glance, there were no serious wounds or broken bones. He removed sharp pebbles from her hip, chin, and palms. From these wounds seeped a watery blood. Christoph rinsed and dried them with a rag. Leah gritted her teeth. "Tell me if it hurts a lot." He bent each of her joints, and Leah clenched her jaw but did not complain. The girl had no broken bones. She had fallen loosely, and many parts of her body had struck the ground at once. She was badly bruised, and nothing more. Christoph dabbed at the new blood with a piece of cotton and applied bandages to the wounds. He lifted Leah gently from the grass and pulled the torn dress from beneath her body. The old armoire hadn't been touched in at least a year, and it creaked and moaned as he unlocked and opened it. On the second level, in gathering dust, he found the folded white dress where he had left it. The child had gathered her knees to her chest, and she was sitting below the sapling when Christoph returned. Mark stood above her with his hands in his pockets, Sabine not far behind him. She murmured something to her brother, and they turned to watch the old man approach. He waved them away. "Begone." The children retreated to the dusty periphery and watched. Christoph gestured for Leah to rise. She looked at him and looked at Mark. The old man hissed at the siblings, and they turned to leave. Leah watched them walk towards the pond. The old man helped Leah to her feet, and she lifted her arms. Once she was clothed, Christoph walked her over to the bicycle and inspected it. Leah clenched her fist and looked closely at the old man for signs of what might come next. She wanted to stay quiet, but the word came anyway. "Mine." Christoph held the bicycle and looked at Leah. She dared not approach him. Her body trembled, and she stood with her bandaged palms open, fingers twitching. Christoph rolled the bicycle over to her and made her grip the handlebar. He let go of the bicycle and returned to the farmhouse. Leah was confused. She blinked and looked down at the bike and up at the farmhouse. Soon Christoph returned with a pump and a can of oil. He pumped the tires and oiled the gears. The old man lowered himself and listened to the tires. Satisfied, he stood again and spun the wheels. There were no leaks and they spun smoothly enough. He showed her how to use the brakes. "Do you understand?" She nodded. Through her tears, Leah watched the old man gather all the nice things he had done for her and disappear into the farmhouse. She left her bicycle in the dirt and ran up to the window to look inside. Christoph was sitting in the rocking chair again, reading a book. He looked like a statue, bust unmoving. Only his eyes skipped back and forth on the page. From behind Leah came the sound of footsteps in the dirt. She spun to see Mark with his cold eyes locked on her bicycle and his sister staring in that awful way. Leah hardened her face and walked past them as best she could, limping on her bruised hip. They stood and stared at her. Leah got on the bicycle and pedaled off, nearly falling again from the pain. She would have to hide the bicycle well. It belonged to her, and so did the dress. She had paid for them both.
What do you think a novel is for today?
There's no other medium for me in which I can become so intimate with myself. I grew up reading a lot and reading very late. I couldn't sleep at night, and I would read for hours alone in my bed in the dark. I don't think I've ever found that exact intimacy with myself. I love technology. I mean, I play a lot of video games. I'm a big fan of movies. I go out to see a lot of films and watch them.
You make films too.
Yeah, yeah. I love film, especially documentary and docufiction and stuff like that. I really, really, really love movies. But I think the novel is able to explore thought patterns and thought formations that is just not possible in other mediums. It just isn't, you know, even if you convert them into audio, it just doesn't work the same way, right? I mean, when you read the words on a page and they are the mental formations or mental patterns of words forming in maybe someone else's mind, and they're echoing in your mind as you read them, it's a form almost of like thoughts, someone else's thoughts, like inhabiting you. Like it's almost like a ghost. I don't know. It's so fascinating to me. And I think that there's something so intimate there. Plus, you are actually probably the most active in terms of your role when you're reading, right? And I don't mean that in the sense of like, oh, you know, you have to make the effort and you're reading the words. Like, no, it's really your mind brings most things to it. I mean, everyone knows the disappointment of like reading a book, loving it, watching the movie and being like, ah, that character doesn't look like that. Or my God, it's set in a totally different location than I thought. Or that's because for everybody, it's set in a different place. And for everybody, the character is different. I know that just sounds trite. I'm not revealing anything new, but there's, you know, you're exploring. It's almost like you're exploring your own mind with the echoing thoughts of someone else. And that's for me, the novel at its best. And that's why I don't really care so much for a lot of literature today, both kind of popular literature and more kind of academic literature or, you know, literary literature, for lack of a better word. It's because I think people... People are interested in like making a point, and also they write in a way that doesn't maybe leave space for the reader, right? So they tend to use adjectives that that tell people how to feel or that like overqualify something. I'm not sure if I'm making any sense, but they kind of paint the whole picture for you. There's nothing left for you to paint. And what I like the most is either, you know, writers who write so simply that there's a lot to be painted around, and then writers that are able to just attempt to put down thought formations. And Faulkner, yes. Okay, so yeah, I'm not a huge fan of him as a human being, and whatever. There's a million caveats with Faulkner, but I think what he does, and he definitely changed my perception of literature because of the way he just kind of inhabits a character. And he doesn't, he really shirks that kind of cinema rule of like in every scene you have to be learning something new about a character or the plot has to move forward. You know, he's able to do to be less involved with that, you know, to somehow break away from that kind of classic narrative structure. And I think that narrative structure of both like manipulation of the audience through emotion and also you know, having a strong kind of point that you're trying to get across somehow or convince people of has infected a lot of writing. Like I just see it everywhere, and I feel like it treats people like idiots a little bit. You know, it's kind of condescending, and I'm not saying it has no role, but it certainly makes books. I think it actually helps books become irrelevant because they're doing essentially what other mediums can do when they do that. You know, I mean. Yeah, like when a movie plays sad music over a scene that's sad, you know, that's kind of almost where we're at. I think, or there's this kind of wave of writers who please themselves very much with how disturbing what they're writing is, right? So they're kind of getting off with the transgression itself, like it's. It's almost like them making the transgression is the real story, right? It's either that or it's like them writing a sad story. That's the story. Like that's when I read a lot of books now, the main story is the writer writing for me. Like, oh, the writer did something clever here. Or, oh, the writer wrote a sad story here. Or, oh, the writer made a very powerful point about, you know, insert topic here. And I find that such a shame because that's exactly the opposite of the novel's unique potential and unique role that still has not, in my opinion, been displaced. So, yeah, it's really difficult to show people to the door, right? But once they get through that door and they're in that dark room or in whatever room their mind is painting for them, like in reaction to these words that are very interpretable, that's magical. That's magic. And sometimes I don't read for a long period of time because I just start reading a book and I'm like, oh God. And I just put it down. I'm like, I can't do this. I just don't. I want to deal with the mind of this writer that is so visible, right?
You've probably been reading my novels.